Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Now, I noticed my title of my paper last night was An Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism. And the title of this paper, this argument, or this talk I want to give, is Against Materialism. So it's got a kind of negative feel to it, you know, both of them against so-and-so. So I'm going to change the title of this talk. It's not against materialism, but for immaterialism, all right? Now, when I speak of materialism, when I speak of materialism, I don't mean the view that everything in the whole universe is a material object, or that there aren't any immaterial objects like, say, numbers, propositions, or sets anywhere in the universe. What I mean by materialism is the view that human beings are material objects, that human beings are material objects through and through. There isn't any immaterial self, or immaterial soul, or immaterial mind. A human being is not an immaterial self that has a body, and a human being, furthermore, doesn't have immaterial parts. That's materialism, all right? And as a matter of fact, materialism is a very popular view nowadays among philosophers and among people who work in the science, in, say, cognitive science, other sciences of this sort. It's a very popular view. Some people think of it as a kind of orthodoxy in these areas. But I want to argue against it. I should say materialism is a popular view at present. Immaterialism, though, the idea that human beings are immaterial selves or have immaterial souls, that's perhaps been that certainly has been the majority opinion, the majority view among Christian thinkers going all the way back, I would say, to the New Testament. All right. At present, there are some Christian materialists. One of my colleagues at Notre Dame, Professor Peter Van Inwagen, is such a person. So there are some, but I think materialism is wrong, a mistake, and that's what I want to argue for in this talk. So I say the title of this talk now is For Immaterialism. Another title would be Two Arguments for Substance Dualism. That would be another way to put it. Two arguments for substance dualism. So what I really propose to argue for is the idea that human beings, I myself, what am I? What kind of a thing am I? I myself am not a material object. I am not a material object. It might be that I have to be connected with a material object in order to function properly. It might even be, as far as my argument goes, that I have to be connected with a material object, embodied in order even to exist. That's a possibility. I'm not arguing that one way or the other. All I'm arguing for is the conclusion that I myself am not a material object. All right? So there are really two arguments then. You see on the first page the replacement argument, an argument from possibility, and on the second page, a second argument, can a material thing think, an argument from impossibility. So one argument from possibility, another argument from impossibility, and that pretty much covers the field, all right? So here's the replacement argument. I'm going to begin by assuming that there really is such a thing as I myself, that I really do exist, all right? I hope you will grant me that assumption. I'm prepared to grant the correlative assumption about you. So, I mean, it's only fair if you agree with me that I really do exist. most philosophers, very few philosophers, have questioned whether they themselves exist, but there is one notable exception. A friend of mine, Professor Peter Unger, at one time, argued that he didn't exist. He himself didn't exist. It's a little hard to figure out exactly how you think about yourself or how you think now if you think to yourself, well, I really don't exist. But he said he didn't exist. And another friend of mine, Professor John Pollock, said, that's the only point on which I agree with Unger, that Unger doesn't exist. Okay, so first of all, I'm assuming that I really do exist, and now, furthermore, I'm assuming that I'm a thing, a substance, a being. If you count up all the things there are in the universe, if you wanted to make a list of them, among them you would have to put me, and also you. All right. Now, I'm going to argue, I say, an argument from possibility. When I speak of possibility, and correlatively then of necessity, I'm thinking of what I call broadly logical possibility or broadly logical necessity. So it's logical necessity, whatever is a theorem of first order logic, let's say, any theorem of logic will be necessary, but there will be other things that are necessary too. For example, the truths of mathematics, they will also be necessary, even though they aren't part of logic, strictly speaking, all right? And then there'll be still other propositions that are necessary in this sense, but aren't either truths of logic or truths of mathematics. For example, no people are prime numbers, or no prime ministers are tricycles, ones like these. These two, they are necessary, but they're not either mathematical propositions or propositions straight from logic. Okay? So that's what I'm talking about here. When I speak of possibility, I mean possibility in the broadly logical sense. Well, here's my first question then on the sheet, just, four little paragraphs down. If I am a material substance, which material substance am I? Okay, so let's think like this. The materialist says that I am a material substance. I'm a human being. All human beings are material substances, so I am a material substance. My question is, okay, if I am one, which one am I? What material substance am I? Well, there are a lot of candidates for what a material substance I'm not. Presumably, I'm not one of those chairs over there. I'm not this projection affair here. I'm not this lectern. A lot of things I'm not. Which material object might I be, then, if I am, in fact, a material object? Well, the answer would be, presumably, I would be my body. This body you see up here, which is a little... which is aging a little worse for wear and so on, but it's still perfectly visible. Here it is. I could be my body, or it could be some part of my body, perhaps my brain, or perhaps part of my brain, or perhaps my whole nervous system. So I could be either my body or some part of my body, or some people would say I could be something that's different from my body, but made up of the same matter as my body is made up of, and located at the same place, co-located, as they say. So, for example, think about a statue. It looks like there are two things there. There's the statue, and there's also the lump of clay or the lump of marble out of which the statue is made, right? It's not at least crazy to think that these are two different things, because it looks like the lump was there before the statue. I mean, before the sculptor did his job, there was a lump of marble there, a block of marble maybe, but there wasn't a statue. So in that case, the statue and this chunk of marble that the statue is made out of are two things, but they're made of the same matter and they occupy the same space. They're co-located. So somebody might say to me, well, you're not your body and you're not any part of your body, but what you are is another material object co-located with your body and made of the same matter. Those would be the possibilities then as to what I might be. I might be my body, I might be some part of my body, or I might be something else that's co-located with my body or part of my body. All right? All right. So here's the argument then. Here's the initial argument. First of all, I want to name my body B. All right? There's me on the one hand, there's B on the other hand. Now the question is whether I just am B or some part of B. So let's name my body B. It seems possible that I continue to exist, now I'm looking at the sheet here, when B, my body, does not exist? That seems possible, and I'm going to argue why that seems possible. I, therefore, have the property of possibly existing when B does not. Here's a property I've got, possibly existing when B does not. But that's the property B doesn't have. But if I've got a property that B doesn't have, then I am not the same thing as B. Put it like this, if there's something true of me that's not true of B, then I and B are two different things, all right? More generally, if you've got objects A and B, and if A has some property that B doesn't have, then A and B aren't the same thing. There are two things there. All right. So I say I've got a property that B doesn't have, namely the property of existing when B doesn't exist. That's my argument in a nutshell. And now I want to argue next for my claim that it's possible that I exist when B does not. That's the second part, okay? So first I say it's possible that I exist when B doesn't. And if that's true, it follows that I am distinct from B. Now, why think that it is possible that I exist when my body B does not? Here I want to give two separate arguments for that, okay? First, at a macroscopic level, at a sort of large-scale level, as opposed to the level of atoms, let's say, or molecules, or electrons. At a large-scale macroscopic level, it seems possible in that broadly logical sense, that medical science should advance to the point where I remain fully clothed and in my right mind, perhaps reading the South Bend Tribune, which is my hometown newspaper, throughout a process during which each of the macroscopic parts of my body, liver, lungs, left leg, left arm, and so on, each of the macroscopic parts of my body is replaced by a different such part, by a different arm, a different leg, a different liver, a different lung, a different heart, etc. And then, this is important here, the original parts being then first reassembled into a body, and then destroyed, vaporized, let's say, by an atomic explosion, all right? So here's what I'm saying is possible. I'm just saying this is possible, not that it's, of course, doable at the moment, but it's logically possible that all the parts of my body should be rapidly replaced within a period of, say, 1.5 seconds. Rapidly replaced, you can imagine it sort of like a CAT scan. If you have a CAT scan, you're sort of strapped to a table and then you go under a big arch. And imagine you go under that arch really rapidly, and it's such that all the parts of your body are then rapidly replaced by other body parts. Maybe one's made of some more durable and some synthetic material that's more durable. So you wind up with sort of like the $6 million man? You've got, this is from 20 years ago, I'm sure you don't remember that, but I remember that. So you might wind up with arms and legs that are much stronger. Who knows? All right? Okay. If that were to happen, if all the parts of my body were replaced at this macroscopic level by other parts and the original parts reassembled, then the reassembled thing would be my body. My body would have been disassembled and then reassembled. And if that is then destroyed, and if throughout I continue to exist, then I would exist at a time at which my body doesn't. All right. Okay. Well, you might say, though, what about my brain? Maybe you don't mind about my heart and my liver, my lungs, my arms, my legs, etc., my ears, eyes, etc. Yeah, those are all okay. Those can be replaced. What about your brain, though? Can your brain be replaced like that? Well, here's another possibility, and that's the next little bit on the sheet there. It seems possible that one hemisphere of my brain be dormant at any given time. Here's a way this could work, a way this could possibly work. The other hemisphere doing all that a brain ordinarily does, so that at any given time, one hemisphere is not doing anything. It's just there, but it's not doing anything, while the other hemisphere is doing all the work that a brain does, all the regulations, all the sending of neural signals to various parts of my body, to the muscles, etc. All right? At midnight, we can suppose, all the relevant data and information from one hemisphere, call it H1, hemisphere number one, is transferred, perhaps via the corpus callosum, which is a thick chain of nerves that connects the two halves of one's brain, to the other hemisphere, H2, whereupon H2 takes over operation of the body and H1 goes dormant. That seems possible. If that happened, if that were the way things are, then it would also seem to be possible that the dormant half, H1, let's say, should be replaced by a different dormant half in the same computational or functional state. In other words, that could be replaced by a different dormant half that was just like the dormant half it was replacing. All right? Could be replaced by a different dormant half, say, just before that midnight transfer. Then the transfer occurs, control switches over to H2, which is now the new H2, and H1 goes dormant, at which time it is replaced by another hemisphere in the same computational or functional condition as it was. So this could happen within a period of a second, let's say. And if that did happen, then, so I say, my brain, and if the original two halves were destroyed, my brain would have been destroyed, but I would continue to exist. What was my brain would have been destroyed. I would have a new brain, but still that brain would have been destroyed, and I would continue to exist. Okay? Well, we might say, okay, maybe that holds for my body and parts of my body. Maybe then I could exist when neither my body nor any part of it existed. But what about this other suggestion about something distinct from my body, some material object distinct from my body and co-located with it, located at the very same place? I haven't said anything really about that. Well, first, I'm not inclined to think there is any such thing as some physical object which is different from my body but located at the very same place. And secondly, if there were such a thing, I'm inclined to doubt that it could survive the replacement of all of my bodily parts at that macroscopic level by other bodily parts. But I want to propose another argument different from either of those for this conclusion that I could exist when that thing didn't exist, if there is such a thing as that. So think about it like this. Let's think about microscopic replacement. That's the next little paragraph on the sheet there. Instead of macroscopic replacement, microscopic replacement. It seems possible that the molecules of which my body is composed, again, logically possible, be rapidly, within a microsecond or two, replaced by other molecules of the same kind and in the same state as the original ones. And then the original molecules be reassembled into a body. I would say that was my original body. And then instantly destroyed. All right? Seems to me, again, this could take place while I remain conscious, thinking about dualism and marveling at some of the appalling arguments against it produced by certain materialists. For example, we just heard Keith Abney just mention Dan Dennett. Dan Dennett proposes, I think seriously, what I think are really crazy, ridiculous arguments against dualism. One of them really goes like this. You can find this in his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Premise: if you don't believe people, prestigious people will laugh at you. If you do believe proposition P, prestigious people will laugh at you. Therefore, not P. That's not, you might say, an imperforate form of argument. Another one like it. Premise: many people who advocate P do so in the service of a hope that science will never be able to explain P. Therefore, not P. I think the fact is, I think you'll find both of those arguments of both those forms in Dennett's book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which I hasten to add is, I think, a really good book. It's very interesting. I think it's completely wrong, but it's nonetheless a very good book. So to go back to my argument then, It seems to me that this microscopic replacement could take place while I remain conscious, thinking about bad arguments like those and other bad arguments against dualism. And if so, since all the matter of my body will have been replaced and destroyed, the original destroyed, the same would go for any object co-located with me that's made of the same matter as my body is made of. Okay, that's the first of the two arguments. Now for the second one. The first argument is an argument from an intuition of possibility, you might say. I say it seems possible when you think about it that the parts of my body should be replaced in that way while I remain conscious, alive, alert, and in my right mind. All right? An intuition of possibility. Some people think that intuition is a frail reed and that you really shouldn't rely on it in doing philosophy. But I think that can't be right, because one has to rely on intuition in doing philosophy, as far as that goes, in doing anything else, in doing mathematics, let's say. Basically, you think that 2 plus 1 equals 3 because you can just see that 2 plus 1 equals 3. It couldn't equal anything other than 3. It's a matter of just seeing this, i.e., it's a matter of intuition. But you might think that intuitions of possibility are a little dicey, shall we say, a little maybe unreliable, have to be treated with great care. Why so? Well, because it seems easy to confuse seeing the possibility of a proposition P with failing to see the impossibility of P. You get that? I say it might seem easy to confuse seeing the possibility of a proposition. I claim I can see that P is possible. You might respond, no, all you really do is fail to see that P is impossible. And it might be hard to distinguish these two. You think about it, you can't see that it's impossible, so you might be inclined to think, well, you see it's possible. But these two are, in fact, distinct things. It's one thing to see that P is possible, and it's another thing to think about it and fail to see that P is impossible. All right? So some people think that arguments from possibility aren't all that strong, just because there is that particular possibility of confusion I just mentioned, that the confusion being, once again, between seeing that P is possible and failing to see that P is impossible. So my second argument, then, is an argument from impossibility. And with respect to impossibility, there doesn't seem to be a correlative possibility of confusion. So my second one is about impossibility. And here's the basic form of this argument. The argument goes like this. No material objects can think. I want to say one can see, if you think about it, that material objects cannot think. They can't reason and believe. They can't entertain propositions. They can't draw inferences and so on. But of course, I can think, and so can you. If so, then you and I are not material objects. All right? Okay, now let's see if we can develop this argument. The first thing I'd like to say is that, of course, this immaterialism isn't original with me, and nor is the argument I want to give for it. This argument I want to give for it really goes back all the way to Plato, but was stated very neatly, I think, by the great German 17th century philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz. All right? Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz gave the argument that I want to, I just want to sort of expand his argument or explain it. So I say my argument here isn't original, but that's okay. The method of true philosophy, let's say, unlike the method of liberal theology or French philosophy, places a much higher premium on truth than on originality. Okay. So here's what Leibniz says in his little pamphlet, the Monadology. He says this, and this is on the sheet there. It must be confessed, moreover, that perception and that which depends on it, and when he speaks of perception, he means thinking generally, not just seeing a tree, but also seeing that 7 plus 5 equals 12, or also feeling a pain, or being appeared to in a certain way when you look out of your window. So he's thinking about thinking generally. He says, it must be confessed, moreover, that perception, and that which depends on it, that perception is inexplicable by mechanical causes. That's what's important here. That is, by figures and motions. And suppose there were a machine so constructed as to think and feel and have perception, we could conceive of it as enlarged and yet preserving the same proportions, so that we might enter it, walk into it, as into a mill, like a windmill, let's say, all right? One that grinds grain or something, or pumps water. And this granted, we should only find on visiting it pieces which push against each other, one piece pushing against another, cogs, that sort of thing, but never anything by which to explain thinking. You just see certain parts of this machine pushing against other parts, but none of that would even suggest that somebody in this neighborhood is thinking, is, say, believing that 7 plus 5 equals 12. This must be sought for, then, that is, thinking, in the simple substances and not in the composite or in the machine. That's Leibniz's basic argument, all right? Okay, there was a movie some time back that involved shrinking, getting really, really small, and then getting into somebody's bloodstream. Anybody remember that? What was that called? What's that?
Inner space.
Yeah. So Leibniz is kind of thinking like that. You might change his example. You might change his example like this. Imagine yourself really shrunk down, and then you crawl into someone's brain, let's say, so you can somehow navigate through the brain, maybe in a little submarine or something like that. You look around, and nowhere will you see anything that explains or even suggests thinking. Okay? So Leibniz is thinking of mental life and perception, thought, decision, generally. And he's saying these things can't arise by the mechanical interaction of parts. By the mechanical interaction of parts. He was thinking just of things pushing and pulling. But I think he would say the same about the other interactions studied in physics. For example, gravity or electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear forces. He would say the same thing about them. Call all these things physical interactions. Leibniz's claim is that thinking can't arise by virtue of physical interactions among material objects or parts of material objects. That's what he's saying, all right? And I think I agree with him. So put it like this. Electrons and quarks, so they tell us, are simple. And so what Leibniz is saying is, you won't get thinking arising from, let's say, in an atom by virtue of the interaction of its parts, namely, say, the electrons, and the proton, which is its nucleus, or if protons themselves are composed of quarks, you won't get a proton thinking by virtue of the interaction of the quarks, which are its parts. You won't get thinking by virtue of interaction of physical parts, physical interaction of physical parts. So far as this argument goes, it could be that a physical simple, like an electron, can think. His argument doesn't say anything about that. But I take it most of us aren't inclined to think that what we really are just electrons. So he's saying, so his claim is that you can't get thinking by virtue of the interaction, the physical interaction of physical parts. Okay, let's look into this a little bit further. Ask yourself this, what would a belief be? Let's think just about beliefs now. Last night I also talked some about beliefs and what they would have to be like. So think just about beliefs. What would a belief be from the materialist perspective? For example, the belief that, say, Marcel Proust, the great writer Marcel Proust, is more subtle than Louis L'Amour. Louis L'Amour is a writer of Westerns. I think he's written maybe 250 Westerns. Louis L'Amour is also from my hometown of Jamestown, North Dakota, where today it was, I believe, 42 below zero. So if Louis L'Amour is still living there, he's probably chilly. So in any event, here's my question. What would a belief be from this materialist perspective? For example, what would the belief that Marcel Proust is more subtle than Louis L'Amour, what would that be? Well, it looks like it would have to be something like a long-standing event or structure in your brain or your nervous system more generally, right? There are, they say, something like 100 billion neurons. So maybe a belief would be like a bunch of these neurons connected together and firing as neurons do, sending messages, sending signals, electrical signals back and forth, and also sending signals to other such structures. That's the sort of thing that a belief would have to be. A collection of neurons or a bunch of neurons or a neuronal event, all right? And any such collection of neurons will have to have two very different properties, as I said last night. On the one hand, this belief will have to have what we might call electrochemical properties or neurophysiological properties, properties like being composed of so many, say, 100,000 neurons, and being such that the rate of fire in one part is X and the rate of fire in another part is Y, being such that when the rate of fire in the one part increases, the same happens to the rate of fire in the other part, or maybe it decreases. Those would all be electrochemical or neurophysiological properties. But it would also have to have a totally different kind of property if it really is a belief. It would have to be the belief that P, for some proposition, you know, something like all men are mortal, or 7 plus 5 equals 12, something that is either true or false. It would have to also have a content. It would have to be the belief that P, for some true or false thing, some proposition, all right? Maybe the proposition, naturalism is all the rage these days. Let's imagine that it's that proposition. It would have to have a content, you might say. And it would therefore have to have, in addition to those electrochemical and neurophysiological properties, also what we could call a semantic property. Semantic meaning. It's got to be the belief that P, for some proposition P, in some sense you could say it's got to mean P, all right? It's got to be connected with that proposition as opposed to other propositions. And well, there next on the sheet it says there is the sentence, naturalism is all the mode these days, translated into German, is all the rage these days. Der Naturalismus ist diese Tage ganz große im Mode. The only point of putting that in there is because I wanted to impress you that I knew how to translate that sentence. Well, that's not quite the only point. A second point is I want to say that beliefs themselves or propositions, they don't come in sentences. So the German speaker, who is not an English speaker, when he believes that naturalism is all the rage these days, he would express that belief in terms of this sentence rather than the one I use, which is the English sentence, naturalism is all the rage these days. So beliefs and propositions, they don't come in different sentences or in languages. Well, now here's the question. How does it happen? How can it be that an assemblage of neurons, a neuronal event, a group of material objects, these neurons are material objects that are firing away, how can it be that they have a content? We can examine this neuronal event as carefully as we please. We can measure the number of neurons it contains, their connections, their rates of fire, the strength of the electrical impulses involved, the potential across the synapses with as much precision as you could possibly desire. We can consider its electrochemical, neurophysiological properties in the most exquisite detail, but nowhere here will we find so much as even a hint of content. In fact, what we see, this chattering array of neurons sending signals back and forth, not only can't we find a hint of content there, we can't even find anything that looks vaguely relevant to content. We just see a lot of neurons that are firing and connected with each other, all right? In fact, I want to go one step further. The fact is, I think, the fact is we can't see how it could have a content. Consider analogies, other cases where we can't see how something could be the case. We can't see how the number 7 could weigh 5 pounds. And it's not because it would have to weigh 7 pounds. We can't see how it could weigh 7 pounds either. A number just isn't the right kind of thing to have a weight, to weigh anything at all. We can't see how an elephant could be a proposition. The proposition, let's say, naturalism is all the rage these days. We can't see how that thing, that proposition, could be an elephant. Not only can't we see how it could be an elephant, we could see that it can't be an elephant. It's not the right kind of thing to be an elephant, all right? So it's not only that we can't see how it could happen. Very often when we say we can't see how so-and-so could happen, what we really mean is we can see that it can't happen. And that's the way it is in these cases. I would say the same thing about neuronal events. They can't, as such, have a content. They can't, as such, be about something. They can't, as such, be that sort of thing. They're not the right kind of thing to do that. These neuronal events are clicking away, sending electrical impulses hither and yon. But that seems to have nothing to do with having content or with being a belief. You might as well say that an ocean wave or a breeze is a belief. Okay. Now I'm going to take just a few more minutes here to examine a certain objection to what I have just argued. There you've really got the two arguments. Now I want to consider an objection. And this objection is from my colleague Peter Van Inwagen, whom I mentioned earlier. He's my colleague at Notre Dame, who I said is a Christian materialist. So he considers Leibniz's argument too. And let's see, take a look at what he says when he considers it. Peter says this: "It seems to me that the notion of a physical thing that thinks is a mysterious notion, and that Leibniz's thought experiment brings out this mystery very effectively." Okay. Now, I've been using Leibniz's suggestion of a problem or mystery in the idea of a material thing's thinking as an argument against materialism and for dualism, for the idea that we human beings are immaterial objects. But of course, if there's the same problem for immaterialism, for an immaterial object thinking, as there is for a material object thinking, then my argument's not going to work. And that's what Van Inwagen argues. So look at what he says next. He says, "It is thinking itself that is the source of the mystery of a thinking physical thing. The notion of a non-physical thing that thinks is, I would argue, equally mysterious. How any sort of thing could think is a mystery. It is just that it's a bit easier to see that thinking is a mystery when we suppose that the thing that does the thinking is physical." Let me read that over again. "It is just that it is a bit easier to see that thinking is a mystery when we suppose that the thing that does the thinking is physical. For we can form mental images of the operations of a physical thing, and we can see that the physical interactions represented in these images, the only interactions that can be represented in these images, we can see that they have no connection with thought or sensation, or none we are able to imagine, conceive, or articulate. The only reason we do not readily find the notion of a non-physical thing, an immaterial thing, that thinks equally mysterious is that we have no clear procedure for forming mental images of non-physical things." So that's what my colleague, my friend Peter Van Inwagen says. So dualism or immaterialism is really no better off than materialism. The problem for materialism is that we just can't imagine, form a mental image of, we can't imagine a material thing thinking. Just can't imagine that, you know, you can't form a mental image of it. But he says the same goes for an immaterial thing. You also can't imagine or form a mental image of an immaterial thing thinking. The fact is, he says, you can't form a mental image of anything thinking. And in fact, he goes on to add, and that's the next little part there, "My point is that nothing could possibly count as a mental image of a thinking thing." Okay. So according to him, the problem for materialism is that you can't imagine a material thing thinking, but he says that's also a problem for immaterialism. So we don't have any argument against materialism. That's his suggestion. But I think my friend Peter, I hate to say this, he's my friend and my colleague, I think he's gone wrong here. I don't think he's really properly located the problem for materialism. The problem is not that we can't imagine or form a mental image of a material thing thinking. There are lots of things that we can't form mental images of that we don't think are impossible, all right? Descartes talked in this connection about a thousand-sided rectangular plane figure, a thousand-sided rectilinear plane figure. So it's got a thousand sides. Well, you can't really imagine that, or at least you can't imagine it in such a way that the imagination, the image, is different from that of a hundred-sided figure of that sort. So you can't really imagine that, but you don't therefore think it's impossible. That's not the problem. I can't imagine or form a mental image of the number 17s being prime. The number 17 is a prime number. Try forming a mental image of the number 17s being prime. You can't do it. It's not the sort of thing that is in that way imaginable. You might be able to imagine in your mind a sentence that says 17 is prime, but that's not sufficient. I mean, that's not really imagining it in the same way there you could imagine most anything. You know, you could imagine a married bachelor in that sense. You could say, well, I can imagine this sentence, Jones is a married bachelor. No problem, right? No, just to imagine such a sentence, 17 is prime, that's not to imagine 17s being prime. There isn't anything that really is forming a mental image of the number 17s being prime. The same goes for, consider the fact that you can't imagine that a proposition is red. The proposition 7 plus 5 equals 12 is red. You can't imagine that either. But in these cases, it's the availability of imagination, of being able to imagine the thing in question, form a mental image of it, that's not important. I can't imagine 17s being prime, but 17 obviously is prime. I don't therefore say 17 can't be prime. It's not possible that 17 is prime just because I can't imagine it. On the other hand, I can't imagine a proposition's being read either, but that's not why I say that's impossible. It's rather that I can see that a proposition can't be read. It's not the right sort of thing to be read. An elephant's not the right sort of thing to be a proposition. Again, not because I just can't form a mental image of an elephant, which is also a proposition, but rather just because you can see that that can happen. One can see on reflection that these things happen. These things cannot happen. Well, the same goes with the physical things thinking. True, one can't imagine it. The reason for rejecting the idea of a physical things thinking, however, is not that one can't imagine it. It's rather that one can see that a physical object just isn't the sort of thing that can do that. It's not the right sort of thing. In a way, Van Inwagen is inclined to endorse this himself. The next little bit there, Leibniz's thought experiment shows that when we carefully examine the idea of a material things having sensuous properties, it seems to be an impossible idea. So it's an impossible idea in the sense that you can see that this idea couldn't be real. It couldn't have an actual manifestation in reality. And the same thing doesn't go for an immaterial object's thinking. That clearly isn't an impossible idea. If it were, there would be a new argument against the existence of God, a new atheistic argument that goes like this. God, if he existed, would be an immaterial object. God also would be a thing that thinks and knows things, but no immaterial thing can think or know things, so there can't be any such person. Nobody would take an argument like that seriously at all. All right? Okay. Well, Van Inwagen has a second suggestion, and with this second suggestion, I will I'll talk about that for a minute, and then I'll be finished. He says this: in general, to attempt to explain how an underlying reality generates some phenomenon is to construct a representation of the working of that underlying reality, a representation that in some sense shows how the underlying reality generates the phenomenon. So you might try to imagine, you might try to figure out how thinking could be generated by a material object or a bunch of material objects working together, all right? You'd have to construct a model that in some sense, a representation or a model that in some sense shows how the underlying reality generates the phenomenon. Essentially, the same considerations as those that show we are unable to form a mental image that displays the generation of thought, the coming to be of thought and sensation, by the workings of some underlying reality, whether the underlying reality involves one thing or many, and whether the things it involves are physical or non-physical, show that we are unable to form any sort of representation that displays the generation of thought and sensation by the workings of an underlying reality. Well, what he's really saying here, it seems to me, is this: we can't see how thought could be generated by the workings of parts. We can't see how thought could come to be by virtue of some objects having parts, which parts work together in the way in which the neurons in one's brain, let's say, might work together. We can't see how that could happen. And that, seems to me, is fatal to materialism. But it doesn't have any bearing on dualism or on immaterialism, because the point is an immaterial self or a soul isn't to be thought of as something that has parts. It's a simple. It's a thing that doesn't have any parts. So, of course, it wouldn't think by virtue of its parts working together in a certain way. True, we certainly can't imagine how that would go. Can't think of how that could be. But that isn't how it would go anyway. It's not by virtue of the workings of the parts of one's immaterial self or soul that thinking arises. Rather, thinking is, you might say, a basic or direct activity of a self, all right, a self or a mind. So as it says here, I guess what it says here is what I just said. An immaterial self, a soul, a thing that thinks, is simple, doesn't have parts. Thought is a basic activity, doesn't come from parts. Hence, of course, thought isn't generated by the interaction of its parts. To ask how does a soul produce thought is to ask an improper question. There isn't any how about it. It isn't done by virtue of its doing something else, its parts working together. You might ask the same question about an electron. How does an electron happen to have a charge? Electrons, they tell us, have negative charges. How does it manage to do that? Well, as physics is constituted right now anyway, there doesn't seem to be any answer to that. That's just the way electrons come. That's what they're like. The same thing would go for propositions. How do propositions manage to be true or have the property of being either true or false? Well, that's just the nature of a proposition. It doesn't do it by virtue of doing something else. So it's true, as Van Inwagen says, that thought can sometimes seem to be mysterious and wonderful, something to marvel at. But the same goes for propositions and sets. How do sets manage to have members? Most things don't have members. How does a set manage to do that? You know, where does it get this mysterious property of having a member? That's really mysterious. Well, it's maybe in some way it is wonderful and mysterious, but on the other hand, it's also perfectly obvious that sets are the sorts of things that can do that. And these properties on the parts of sets and propositions and minds and thinking can't be explained by way of physical interaction among material parts, but that's nothing at all against sets. Indeed, these properties can't be explained at all. Of course, if you begin with the idea that everything has to be a material object, then thought and propositions and sets would indeed be mysterious and paradoxical. But why begin with that idea? Thought is seriously mysterious, I think, only when we assume that it would have to be generated in some physical way by physical interaction among physical objects. That is certainly mysterious. Indeed, it goes far beyond mystery, all the way to apparent impossibility. But that's not a problem for thought. It's a problem for materialism. Thank you. So I think we have some time for questions. Anybody have any questions or suggestions? Or
I was just wondering, why can't we be both material and immaterial simultaneously? Why must we be forced into such binary thinking? I mean, just from observation, when the psyche is harmed, there's always a physiological response, and when we're physically harmed, the psyche is always affected. So it seems like that there are two parts of the same whole. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, the first part of your question is, why can't we be both material and immaterial? If I am a thing, and if an immaterial thing just is a thing that's not material, that's what immaterial would mean, then clearly I can't be both. I can only be either a material thing or else an immaterial thing. I can't be both. But it might be that, and in fact it is, according to substance dualism, the case that as an immaterial thing, I'm very closely connected with a certain material thing, namely this body, my body. And what happens to my body certainly has a causal effect on what happens to me as an immaterial substance or self. Just as what happens to myself, my deciding to do a certain thing, let's say, will have effects in my body. So I decide to walk over here, walks over there, right? So the fact that there is this connection between body and mind, or between self and body, that doesn't mean that I myself am a material object or am partly material or something like that.
Okay. I still don't quite understand, because we are constituted of material and immaterial things. I just don't understand why we have to take a polar stance on being either materialist or immaterialist. I mean, it seems like we're both. I mean,
well, we can't be both. If an immaterial thing just is a thing that's not material, and that's how I'm using the term. So I say we got material and immaterial, like married and not married. You can't be both, ordinarily anyway. You can't be both. I mean, either you're married or you're not. Either you're 5 feet tall or you're not. Similarly, either you're a material object or you're not. And to be immaterial just is not to be material. But that doesn't mean that nothing material has effects on you as an immaterial object. Of course it does. There are connections between body and mind, and by virtue of things happening to your body, various things happen to your mind, and vice versa.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Keith.
Yes, since I did bring up Dennett, and since your final part that you didn't mention does bring up the Millikan-Dennett response to your argument, I thought I'd go ahead and play devil's advocate, so to speak, and see what you have to say. Dennett wants to say that representations can play the roles that we ascribe to beliefs, and hence that if we're going to ascribe something in addition to beliefs, like intentionality, that goes beyond what representations do, that's just not required. So that there's no distinction in principle between us and, say, a thermostat, just in terms of the complexity of the representations. Now, the question would be something along these lines. Suppose Dennett's busy building Cog and other robots at his lab at Tufts, right? And they all use representations in the sense we all agree on, I take it. Suppose Cog, at one point, is able to pass the Turing test, so it can produce behavior indiscernible from that of a human being. Why would we believe then that we have beliefs and it doesn't?
Well, I would believe that because the fact that somebody can build something that acts just like a person, so that when I say to it, well, nice day, right? It says, yeah, it's a nice day. This thing says the right things under the right conditions, the fact that we could build something like that doesn't suggest to me for a moment that this thing thinks. I mean, it might just be an elaborate machine that somebody built. The fact that it can, that it says the right thing, that the right sorts of sounds issue from its mouth, I can't see really why anybody would suggest, would think that so much as even suggest that the thing actually has beliefs or thinks. So my objection to Dennett is really that he says this, if you look on the sheet there, he says an indicator, so he thinks that there are, so everybody thinks there are lots of indicators, that is, there are processes which are causally correlated with or connected with other processes, the way in which, say, springtime and the warming up is correlated with the coming out of leaves, all right? There's that sort of indication relation. Looking at the one, you know something about the other. Well, he really says, and Millikan does too, that an indicator gets to be a belief when evolution confers on that indicator, when it confers on it the function of causing adaptive behavior. All right, so you've got this indication relation. When evolution confers on the indicator of something else, when it confers on it the function of causing adaptive behavior, then you've got a case of belief. But that seems to me completely and wildly wrong. There's all kinds of indication relations in one's body. There are structures that indicate, say, the salinity, the salt content of your blood, the temperature of your blood, your blood pressure. And furthermore, these structures do have the function of causing adaptive behavior. So if the temperature of your blood gets too high, then sweating occurs, which will cool it. If your blood pressure gets too low, then something else happens, all right? But no one, including Dennett, as far as I know, thinks that anything in the neighborhood like those indicators, or like I myself, under those conditions, believes that the blood pressure is too high or has too much salt in it or is too warm or is too cold. It's a mistaken account, because it will ascribe belief to lots and lots of cases where there seem to me, and where seem to everybody else too, I would say, not to be any. Okay, yes.
This is, I guess, along the same lines as Dr. Abney. Considering the fact that we're talking about logical possibility, and the point may be that I am just failing to see the impossibility of this proposition, but considering the idea that at this time when you're going to be doing this fancy surgery, switching out all the body parts, that there may be, we may be advanced in technology enough to have created a machine that can, I don't necessarily want to say think, but can learn, and that could be self-aware to work in the same means as a human being does. Like, if technology was advanced that far, what are the implications of that being in regards to materialism?
Well, what I was saying really so far was that I am not, at any rate, I am not a material object. That part of the argument doesn't really say that no material object could think. The second argument does that. But the first argument about the replacement just says I can't be identical with my body because it's possible that while I remain conscious, my body should be replaced by other bodily parts, the originals put together and destroyed. So I can't be the very same thing as my body. That's how that argument goes. As for the, I mean, I guess your question really should be directed at the second argument. It should say, well, maybe someday technology will get to the point where we will be able to make a machine that can think. You know, we haven't got there yet, but maybe someday we will be able to do that. Well, not if my argument is right. I mean, my argument says we can see that physical interaction between physical parts can't produce thought. You can't get thought that way. It's got to come in some other way. Now, I mean, I have to admit my argument isn't sort of totally irrefragable. It does depend on that intuition, and maybe not everybody sees things the same way. What I ask you to do then, just think about it some more. Think again about Leibniz's example. You know, you imagine yourself entering into someone's brain. Let's say you see all these electrical impulses going this way and that way. Now the question is, could that somehow, those impulses going this way and that way, constitute thought or constitute belief?
I guess if we were to look at like a modern computer system, if we were to take a microscope and look at electrons flying around in circuitry, you can't necessarily understand what's going on the operating system level. In the same, like, we're looking at the brain as a computer with neurons firing and flashing around, but by looking at that, we don't know the fact we're running Linux, for example. Uh-huh.
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think on page 3 I refer to that, although I didn't go into it. Somebody might say, well, look, consider a computer. A computer is a mechanical device of some sort, mechanical, electrical, but the computer has got aboutness. It's about something. I mean, you type in something, here comes a sentence. The moon is not made of green cheese. That seems to be about the moon. So doesn't the computer have intentionality or aboutness, or doesn't some part of it, maybe the whatever it is by virtue of which that sentence is stored on its disk, doesn't that have intentionality? That's really or aboutness, that's really the same question as whether or not an English sentence, like the moon is not made of green cheese, whether that has intentionality or aboutness, all right? And the answer is, well, it does, okay, but it only has derived intentionality. That sentence is about the moon just because we use it in a certain way. We use it to express the thought that the moon is not made of green cheese. And when I utter it, then I express that thought, and I also cause you to think the thought, have the thought. And that's the way in which it has intentionality. It doesn't have original or derived intentionality. If it weren't for us human beings, it wouldn't be about anything. It would just be a bunch of sounds or just be a bunch of shapes. And the same goes for whatever it is that stores that sentence in a computer. Yes?
What do you see as the most important or pressing ramification, be it political, ethical, scientific, of accepting substance dualism or immaterialism?
Well, I don't know if it's got any sort of political ramifications. I suppose everybody instantly gave up materialism and became immaterialists. Well, they'd probably all vote Democrat, maybe. I don't know. I can't really see any such political.
I mean, would you see a behavior change?
Sorry?
Would you see a behavior change?
I don't really know whether you would. It might be that if you thought of human beings just as material objects, you'd be inclined to treat them somewhat differently than if you thought they really were immaterial objects, that they were, in this respect, like God, let's say, who is also an immaterial object. It might be that there would be changes in people's behavior, but I'm not really sure. So I guess I can't really answer that question. Yes?
I was wondering if you had an answer to explain how an immaterial self could cause the material neurophysiological responses in the brain that cause our behavior?
Yeah. That's always been an objection to substance dualism. People have said, well, it just isn't possible that an immaterial thing should cause changes in the hard, heavy, massy physical world. That seems to me not to be a very good objection, though. At least it's certainly not a very good objection for anybody that's inclined to take Christianity at all seriously. Because there, the thought is, God, who is himself an immaterial object, not only has causal consequences in the world, he caused the whole world. He created it, caused it to be. And there doesn't seem to be any impossibility in that suggestion, as far as I can see, along those lines. I mean, once again, if that were really impossible, then there ought to be another atheistic argument here. God, if he exists, caused the world. But God, if he exists, is an immaterial being, no material being could cause no immaterial being could cause anything material. Therefore, there isn't any such person as God. But again, nobody would take that seriously. We don't have that kind of insight into causality so that we can just see that no immaterial thing could cause changes in a material thing, or that any material thing could cause changes in an immaterial thing. If you take some of the main theories of causality nowadays, for example, some of them really take causality to be a matter of certain counterfactuals holding. And there's no reason in the world why there can't be counterfactuals where the antecedent is about some material thing and the consequent about something immaterial. Okay? Yes?
I wanted to add something to that first objection of why we self could not be both material and non-material. Because it does seem like in this world there are examples of things that do appear to be both material and non-material, like an electron, for example, under some situations can only be explained as being a material substance, whereas in other situations it can only be explained as being energy or non-material substance. That in physics they call it the matter-energy duality of certain things. I was wondering why the existence of self couldn't be explained in a similar way, where when looked at in some situations we appear to be physical, and in other situations we appear to be non-physical.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, these are paradoxes in physics, and there are other paradoxes in, say, ordinary quantum mechanics or quantum mechanics understood under the orthodox interpretation, the Copenhagen interpretation. And so they don't really explain much in a way, you know. If somebody says, well, maybe it's like this, and then you get some other mystery. But in this particular case, I would take it that energy, say electrical energy, this is a property, this is a material, something itself material, or a property of something that's material. So it's not in that regard like what something would have to be both material and immaterial. And also, remember, I'm just explaining materiality, immateriality. I'm saying what that is just the denial of materiality. So if that's how you're using the terms, obviously nothing could be both material and immaterial. Yeah.
You're suggesting that thoughts don't come necessarily from a material body of interaction or the parts that are in a material substance. So where are you suggesting the thoughts and beliefs that we do have come from? And if it's something like a soul, could you be willing to offer a functional definition of what that might be in light of the talk today?
Well, a functional definition, I guess I would say a thing that thinks. That's how Descartes said what a self was. It's a thing that thinks. That's a functional definition. It's got the function of thinking. Okay, well, thank you all very much.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.